Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast, supporting you on your mothering journey during pregnancy, birth and beyond. Through yoga, education and community, we enable every woman we work with to connect more deeply to herself and her own innate wisdom. Find your tribe as you become a parent, making positive, informed choices that are right for you, because Lush Tums believes everything has a place. Join the two Claires as we connect, laugh and learn. In this space, everything is welcome. Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast. I'm Claire McGill.
And I'm Claire Maddalena.
Today, Claire and I are joined by one of our absolute favourite guests, Mark Harris. Mark came to speak to us last series about birth and men in particular, and we touched upon some of his work with people who are suffering from birth trauma. Claire and I have both done Mark's three-step training, and we are really keen to delve into that today and let you know a little bit more about it and talk about trauma generally and what that might look like for people who are experiencing it. So welcome today. Lovely to have you, Mark.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Oh, hi, Mark. It's really lovely to see you again. Thanks for coming back on.
Pleasure.
So before we begin, let's talk a little bit about trauma generally and what that might look like to someone who's experiencing it. Do people always know that they've been traumatized? Can it manifest unconsciously?
This might sound controversial when I first say it, but I think we've got to acknowledge that trauma is in many ways like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. You know, when we start to use the word trauma, there's a sense in which there is no trauma out there, but trauma gets formed on the inside as a response to what happens to us. So, and that's not to diminish people's experience of trauma. You know, whatever a person is experiencing is real and occurs to them as the truth. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So early on in my career, I looked after two women that gave birth in the home from home. I've been qualified about 6 years. They both gave birth in water. They both had dim lights. They both had music playing. They both were the first people to bring their baby to their chest. They both had a physiological third stage under the water. One of them went on to talk about their birth as life enhancing. And the other woman ended up with a diagnosis of PTSD. If you'd have watched the birth experience, you know, on a telly, you'd have said they were the same. But inside the experience of one of those women, they were traumatized. You know, now back to your question, Claire. Any automatic emotional response that a person has no control over that's causing them suffering could be called trauma. You know, it could be called trauma. And you're right. There are people out there that are experiencing flashbacks, anxiety attacks. They can't walk near a hospital. I've worked with a client that the smell of the hospital would induce tachycardia and tachapnea. I think we hear a lot about trauma out there, but there would be, I'm guessing, a vast group of people that are experiencing symptoms that are causing them suffering.
And in a way, it's a completely natural response to an event that's occurred.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, let's be frank. You know, we've had the amygdala, that part of our brain, you know, the four Fs, fight, flight, freeze, and reproduction. You know, it's that part of our brain that for millions of years has been keeping us safe. So before we had the neocortex, which is not long at all, we were just an animal a species of mammal responding to stimulus on the outside in such a way that we kept ourselves safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like that frog that you try and catch, that when the shadow of your hand goes over him or her, they jump quicker than you can catch them. You know, it's that stimulus response. And the amygdala evolved to keep us safe. Now, since we developed language and the neocortex, we can now talk about our experience and we can invent the idea of us being a person with a future and a past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before language, there was no future, there was no past, because I was just a mammal responding to the stimuluses in my environment in order to keep safe and have babies.
Mm.
Right? Now, with language, I've invented Mark Harris. And Mark Harris is a person who has a future and a past and needs for security and needs to earn a living and needs to be loved and need to fit in. So now I can have this fight or flight response when I perceive that who I am as a person is under threat.
Mm-hmm.
When someone puts me down at work, inverted commas, or when someone behaves towards me in a way that I consider bullying. So it's our brain is working perfectly to keep us alive and well.
I love what you just said then, Mark, because it's a very science and evolutionary way of framing it that ties so beautifully into our yoga philosophy and Buddhism. Mm. That it's all about, if we can be in the present, we're going to reduce our suffering, and that suffering comes when we're thinking, worrying about the past or stressing about the future. That's where our suffering lies. So
yeah.
I love that relationship of the two.
Yeah, there's a. I think more and more the philosophies of, you know, Buddhism and Zen are having some validation because of neuroscience.
Well, neuroscience, you know, is catching up with what they've been saying for centuries.
Exactly. You know, the idea that the experience I'm in is Maya or illusion, mm-hmm, is really quite clever. Because in this very moment, you know, I think I am seeing the colours of your T-shirt and the colour of your hair. And of course, I'm not. What's out there are light waves of different frequencies coming at my visual cortex and then being transformed into colours on the inside. So my experience of this moment is fundamentally unique to me.
Mm.
Not only that, my brain is a predictor of what is going to occur. So in any given moment, my brain is filling in bits of information based on past experience and designed to keep me safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said it was like thousands of bits of information when we were doing our training together. And it's like our brains can't literally do all of that. So it's going to edit and pick and choose.
Yeah. So we've developed a filtering system, if you like. It's a metaphor. So because there is, I said thousands, it's probably millions of bits of information coming in at any one time. I can't, my neurophysiology cannot process it all. So I have to delete bits, generalize bits, distort bits in order to create a kind of an internal simulation of what's going on so that I can live my life. And it's, mm-hmm, happening all of the time, and I cannot stop it happening.
The one time I really notice this is when my partner's like trying to look for the car keys, and he literally goes, I can't find the keys. I can't see the keys. Where are the keys? And he keeps telling himself he can't see them. And I walk along and just point to them because they're literally on the table in front of him. But he's obviously edited it out.
It happens all the time in our house.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the same. It's the same if two people are telling the story of something they witnessed.
Mm-hmm.
You realize they're not seeing, they're not having the same experience.
And a bit similar to your story about the two women that had very similar birth experiences, one of my dear friends and midwife when she had her first. It was the home birth at home in the pool, and she was supported by two friends, neither of whom had had children. And it went really beautifully, you know, kind of lovely birth. And one of her friends who watched it and observed was like, that was amazing. I can't wait to do that. And the other woman who completely saw exactly the same birth was, you're crazy. Why would you want to do that? I'm never doing that.
Yeah. I feel the same when I watch someone bungee jump.
Are you pro bungee jumping or against?
Well, I just think, God, why are you doing that? And of course, inside their map of the world, that is called excitement. And in fact, I remember once when I was really heavy, I think I was about 28 stone, and I went on an Outward Bound course, and we had to do this abseiling, and I was frightened, but all my female midwifery colleagues weren't, and so I couldn't back out. So I'm 28 stone something, and I said to this guy, does that rope have a weight limit? And he said, oh yeah. He said, you get a minibus on this rope. I said, have you ever had a minibus on it? He said, no. He said, you're going to be the closest we've come, which was really offensive. But
what you're saying about bungee jumping, I am terrified of heights, but I did one in New Zealand. I like to try and challenge myself. But as I was walking towards the end of the thing, I was doing it with my husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, and as we're walking towards the edge, I could literally feel the buzzing excitement from him. Yeah. And my whole body was totally shutting down, like every part of me was desperate to grip onto the rail and to not, you know, every little part of me didn't want to do it. And I actually don't remember jumping, and I don't remember anything until we were collected by the boat at the bottom. Like, my brain is completely blanked out.
That makes sense, actually. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it, from the point of view of keeping you safe?
Have
you seen videos of it, Claire?
Yeah, I have, and it doesn't bring back anything. I can remember the top, I can remember the countdown, and then I remember sort of dangling at the bottom waiting for the boat to come and get us. But yeah, totally blanked out. We did a skydive as well a few days later. We really went for it this holiday, and that was like the best experience ever. I absolutely loved it. But in my brain, it sounds crazy, but seeing the clouds below me, I was like, oh, it's like the Care Bears. The clouds are going to catch me. I'm fine. I'm safe. Whereas being on a bridge, I think, was so related to an everyday experience, but doing something completely not every day. My brain definitely couldn't handle it, and totally blacked it out.
In a way, I guess, because I don't have many similar experiences of doing things that I'm afraid of in terms of physical death. But in a way, that potentially becomes a breakthrough moment, don't it? You know, you are telling your brain, Claire, that you can overcome this fear. It paves the way for some extraordinary risk taking, which can be exhilarating, right?
And actually, that's quite interesting that I felt like when I had my second birth experience with my daughter, I felt that actually helped heal me with some of the issues I had around the first experience.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of my clients, women, because a lot of my clients for the birthing awareness three-step process have obviously had an experience already that they're suffering from, you know, and some of those clients, what led to them encoding the memory or storing the memory and labeling it traumatic? Some of the things are quite unexpected. So, for example, the way a consultant conducted a vaginal examination and some of the language they used that was almost throwaway language, but embedded in the thinking of the woman experiencing it, you know. So this is a warning in a way to medical professionals and birthing professionals, is that everything we say, a woman and her partner have to make sense of what we're saying based on their own experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we say the word, we are talking from our simulation or from our experience, but the word does not mean exactly the same to the client hearing it.
Well, I did a little post on a birth trauma group and asked... Woo!
How brave.
Yeah, I was brave and I said, you know, in three words of less, what could have happened differently for you not to have been traumatised during giving birth?
Nice.
And within about 72 hours, I had 435 comments. And I would say that 90% of them went into not being listened to, not being heard, not being supported, needed to be respected, needed informed consent, needed to be listened to. It literally, like, being listened to and informed consent were the two things that kind of came up again and again and again.
And it makes, for me, that makes sense in the context of the illusion of control. You know, every human being, every mammal of our species is craving the illusion of control. And I call it an illusion because, you know, the idea that we can control anything is ridiculous. But even right this moment, I want the illusion of control. I mean, we all know that my heart could stop the next minute and I'm gone. I'm not here. We all know that we're thundering through space at thousands of miles an hour on a rock.
There's the perfect distance away from the sun. And if we were just a few more miles away, it would be game over.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I remember a story. Do you remember Dick Turpin? Have you heard of Dick Turpin, the highway? Yeah. And he used to say, stand and deliver your money or your life. And he held someone up. He said, stand and deliver your money or your life. And the guy said, take my life because I'm saving for my retirement. And I think that's it's a really good illustration of how most people live their lives. They're expecting life to be better when they've lost weight, when they've got a partner, when they've got enough money, when they're in the right house, you know, when they've got the right job. It's an illusion. Because there is no when.
Yeah, there's only the present.
Exactly. Life has turned up and this is it. You know, now I'm not saying that we should live everyday life like it's our last day because we'd be doing different things than sitting and talking to each other.
Claire would be bungee jumping.
I would be making love to my wife if she was in the mood.
If you put the bins out.
Yeah, exactly. But the truth of the matter is that today, thousands of people will wake up on an ordinary day that they are planning to drift their way through, wishing for a life when things are better. And it's going to be this ordinary day that turns out to be their last ordinary day. You know, so I do my best to live every day like it's my last ordinary day.
Mm. That was something you shared in our beautiful training, and it so stayed with me. Like every day I'm like waking up and going, let's hope this is just another beautiful ordinary day. Yeah.
Ordinary day. I was thinking yesterday of having a hand tattoo. Now, I'm not big into tattoos. I've had a few. My first one was at 44 when my first wife died. I'm thinking of having now written on my hand or something similar to kind of remind me, you know, that life doesn't occur when. Mm-hmm. It's only ever occurring in the moment I'm in. That's it. It doesn't occur anywhere else, you know.
So looping back round to people's experiences with trauma, they might be in the present moment, but their internal experience is getting dominated by some past event. And whether that's something in their environment that's reminded them or using the buzzword triggered them, or whether it's like a constant memory of what went on, they're kind of stuck a bit in the past.
Yeah. Or even this is happening usually outside of their conscious awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say the majority of the clients that I see are not conscious of what it is that's triggering this response they're having. Yeah. Now, there'll be a large number of those clients who think they know consciously. I gently suggest that actually what we consciously think we know is barely the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. What's happening is being triggered to run outside of awareness, and is affecting, I mean, some of my clients, you know, they've not been intimate with their partner since they gave birth, and they gave birth a long time ago. You know, they've not been around baby clothes, or they can't go to mums and tots. You know, there are some clients I have that even looking at their baby triggers a panic response.
And I've had some now that the idea of relaxing or going to sleep or getting to the relaxation at the end of the class is a triggering response, because they had taught themselves the importance of relaxing throughout labour, that it was so important, and it is.
Yeah.
But then it all went a bit crazy and a bit wrong. So now she's associated relaxing with her trauma. So it was something to really disentangle that.
Yeah.
And also that's the time when you are coming into stillness where you can no longer avoid, can't you? Where the thoughts, the feelings, the sensations can come up, because we're very good at making ourselves busy. We're very good at distracting ourselves. And by asking ourselves to enter that place of stillness, no wonder our, you know, at that opportunity, our body goes, right, we need to deal with this. Like, I'm bringing it up. And no one wants to. It's scary.
I think you're right. The realization that actually the thoughts that run on their own do not really need me to run. You know, if I sit, maybe I'll count my breath, right, to 10. I'll rarely get to 10 before my thinking has taken over. And the realization that I am not actually consciously generating the thinking is quite profound. Well, who is then? you get lost in a thought, and then you think, well, I wasn't conscious of starting that thinking. It runs on its own, right?
Like a program running in the background.
Runs on its own. And because every experience we have gets encoded by virtue of our senses, our data receiving senses. So every experience we have is made up of all of our sense representations on the inside. So there are pictures, there are sounds. You know, there are moving pictures, still pictures, collages of pictures. There's internal voices coming from the left, from above, from the right. There are voices. There are mum's voices. There are dad's voices. There are teacher's voices. All of this is going on as we access a memory, you know. And back to what you said, Claire, clients that are suffering, the suffering is happening now. And the replaying of the memory is happening now, you know, but it's an unnecessary suffering.
So how can we help these people that are suffering? And not everyone has, you know, say a traumatic birth and then goes ahead into their new life as a new mum going, I've had a traumatic birth and this is now influencing everything I do, and I am continuously suffering because of this one experience. For a lot, some people do, absolutely, that is how it kind of presents, but for a lot of people, maybe they find they are unable to find joy in life. Perhaps they are feeling like they're not safe, like constantly having to be on alert, their baby's not safe. Maybe they find things that they used to find easy and manageable somehow are no longer possible for them. It can look so different for each person.
Definitely.
Sometimes it's really hard to spot.
Definitely. And it's often, you know, becoming a new mum is so transformative. Sometimes it's sort of lumped in with that experience by itself.
Yeah, and speaking of cis heterosexual men that I've worked with, usually it's their partner that's noticed first. You know, so their partner has picked up that he's more irritable or quicker to get cross about stuff. You know, he's lethargic. He's not engaging in the way that he used to. You know, any reference to the birth, he reacts and moves away and distances himself. So certainly when working with cis heterosexual men particularly, that's a pattern I've seen, increasing drinking alcohol.
Yeah,
you know, all these things can be signs. But I would hasten to add that any automatic emotional response that someone is having that they would prefer more choice over at some level is causing suffering to that person. And the process that both you have learned and that I teach can be very effective in those things. So, you know, I've worked with a client who every time he saw his mother-in-law wanted to smack her in the mouth. And it was an automatic emotional response that he wanted more choice over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't want to love his mother-in-law necessarily, but he wanted to be with her and be able to see her in the moment and respond appropriately to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because in the context of this model, if we're not careful, we never see anyone as they are in the moment. We're only ever seeing them through our past experience of how they've behaved.
And projecting.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, so that person that irritates you, all you have to do is hear their whiny voice and your system is activated and responding to past experience. So I'm never seeing someone as they are right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's only as a reaction to how they've been in the past.
So this work that Claire and I have studied with you, that you've been sharing for the last few years, you know, has been very related to birth trauma, because that's kind of where, you know, your midwife experience has led you. But it could be from any kind of traumatic experience that someone's had.
Yeah, it can be any experience that the person is suffering from and wants more choice. That's the bottom of it. The pattern itself is based on neurolinguistic programming, which is based on Alfred Korbitsky's work called General Semantics back in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the more I read of General Semantics, the more I realize that NLP took its form from General Semantics. And it's not a therapeutic modality. In a way, it's a communication model, or it's a teaching and learning model. NLP says that it studies the structure of human experience and that all human experience has a structure. Now, to put that more simply, we receive information in through our senses and we record it in our kind of metaphorical filing cabinet as pictures, sounds, sensations and smells. That's it. So we have this simulation that runs that helps us live our lives. So this model isn't rooted in therapy. It's based on guiding a client through a kind of guided meditation. And the client, as they follow the instructions, re-encode the memory in such a way that it disconnects the memory from the alarming amygdala that's been going off to keep them safe. So you get to keep all the memories, all the wisdom that makes you you, but without the suffering that you've experienced until now, and you gain more choice. Back to your question though, yes, I've used this process with many people for many different issues, whether it's a fear of flying, a fear of lifts, whether it's mother-in-laws, someone with a baked bean phobia, believe it or not, a community midwife that didn't even have to know she was driving to a traffic light before she was consciously aware began to panic. I've used it with clients who feel that they're being bullied by someone at work. So a whole range of ways of being, not just trauma. Now, in the UK, 4 years ago, the Birth Trauma Association said that 200,000 women a year classify their birth as traumatic, and that was pre-COVID. So who knows what the figures are now?
Mm-hmm. It's a hot topic. You know, I go on social media and we're all talking about trauma or trauma-informed ways of working with people. There's been some amazing work by people like Dr. Gabor Mate, you know, his great little film that was on the internet, The Wisdom of Trauma, his books. There's loads of great books like The Body Keeps the Score. And
Penny Simpkins, Peter Levine, and The Body Keeps the Score. Obviously, that's the one that kind of showcases EMDR.
Mm-hmm.
EMDR is really interesting because Shapiro, who packaged EMDR, which the NICE guidelines kind of recommend now, although the evidence is shifting a little bit, but EMDR has its history in the model of neurolinguistic programming. Shapiro worked with Professor John Grinder, who was one of the creators, if you like, of neurolinguistic programming. But it's another way of interacting with the structure of experience. And I think it's working at a structural level rather, and this is a key distinction, the work that I do and that you've learned is not working with the meaning the client is making about their experience. It's working with how the experience has been encoded.
Mm-hmm.
And it's seeking to guide the client to make a shift in that encoding so that the intensity of the experience is diminished. And in fact, the vast majority of my clients, when I ring them up to check in, it's almost like they've forgotten they've done the work. It's almost like they forgot.
Yeah, it's that effective.
Yeah, because the trigger from the external world or the external to consciousness, mm-hmm. the trigger is happening outside of consciousness. That trigger is not causing the pattern to run anymore.
Yeah.
So they don't register the experience at all.
Yeah, the field's looking in a different direction now.
Exactly. So that community midwife, I rang her up. I said, how are you doing? She said, great. Silence. I said, well, you must have driven. You're a community midwife. She said, yeah, I have. I said, well, you must have seen a traffic light. She said, I have. I said, what was it like? She said, it was like being at a traffic light. You see, the pattern didn't run.
Mm. So you probably barely remember the sensations and experiences that she had previously been going through. I sometimes wish we could do a little video with someone before they go through the process and show them themselves compared with after, because we as practitioners see such a physical change sometimes, such a the way they Definitely. Hold their body, the way their voice works, you know, so much for us it's so kind of clear that something has been lifted. And yet I don't think the person experiencing it, they don't see it through our eyes. Again, that's our program running, I suppose.
Yeah. But well, yeah.
One of the very kind people I had that helped me out when I was training by sharing their experience and doing the process with me, it turned out she was actually a GP. I had no idea about that before we started the process, but it came out as part of her story that she told me. And I found it really interesting that she was obviously coming from a medically trained background, that she was willing to try this, and she did. And the response was really fantastic. And she was very supportive of me doing this work. And in fact, she actually wrote a blog anonymously about her experience of going through the process with me, including her thoughts before, during, and after. And that's something specifically I wanted to do, because I think a lot of people have anxieties and worries about trying this, or they doubt that it's going to be helpful. So to actually have someone who is medically trained, who has gone through it and come out the other side saying she would definitely recommend it, for me was a really I feel really proud of that. It makes me feel, as Mark was saying, like this really is the right thing to be doing, and a great way to help people.
Shall we explain a little bit about what these sessions might look like for someone that might be interested in finding a three-step practitioner and looking at, you know, resolving some of the things they're struggling and suffering with? What might that look like for a client?
I'll tell you that, I mean, the process that I teach is called the Birthing Awareness three-step process. And I teach it in the context of three separate sessions. So the first session can be done on Zoom. In fact, throughout the apocalypse, Zoom has been as effective as face-to-face in terms of feedback. So the first session would involve you going to see the practitioner, who you can find, by the way, on the practitioner page at www.birthingawarenesstraining.com. All the people on the practitioner page are accredited. And are currently active because they need to be to stay on the page. So the first session would be you being given a choice whether you want to talk about your experience or not. Because with this process, you don't have to tell your experience. The practitioner can work without any information about what's happened to you.
I think that is so powerful because so much talking therapy is about regurgitating your experience. And I think a lot of people that have had a big traumatic experience, they are then reliving that and having the same firing offs in their brain, the same hormone responses, the same feelings of everything, which might not be super useful for them.
Well, if we look at the data, Claire, you know, in the context of PTSD diagnosis, 50% of clients that get a diagnosis resist the therapies that are available for them. And it makes total sense because the pain involved in reliving that is so intense that they don't want to go near it.
So avoidance is actually a criteria of the diagnosis.
Yeah, it is. Whether you use the World Health or the American guide, avoidance is a key criteria.
I think we often find people are keen to share their stories in some way. I know a lot of people, because they didn't feel listened to during the experience, this is their opportunity to really be listened to. And I think for a lot of people, that really does help, especially if they've not had a chance to speak about it with anyone else.
Yeah, well, I've been using this process for about 18 years, right? And in the context of birth, very rare that someone doesn't want to tell me about their experience. Very rare. And while we're talking about that, I never talk about the client's story, because I've had too many clients that when I say the word story, say, this happened, this isn't a story. And from the context of people having this experience, that's how it occurs to them. This is the truth. But yeah, in the context of birth, I think that's because in our society, women predominantly, cis heterosexual women or gay women for that matter, when they talk about their birth, they're either concerned that their birth was too positive and they don't want to sound like they're kind of bigging it up and, you know, putting anyone else down who's had a bad experience.
Boasting.
And then you've got the other group of women who have had a horrendous experience from their perspective, and they don't want to share it because they don't want to scare people, because they've been told that that will be negative and it will scare people. And then they go to debrief and they tell their story and the midwife corrects it. So they haven't had an opportunity in a kind of an open space to talk about their experience. Now, when we're listening to the client's story, we're listening in a very different way to other people. You know, we're hearing the details, but we're listening for the words and phrases that a client's using to describe their experience. And we are watching their body, because their body is the end point of the pattern that's running on the inside. So it's like the body is the output of the pattern running. So we're looking at muscle tone. We're looking for breathing, where it's happening, pace of speaking, all of those things. And this enables us, I think, to be I don't know. It's almost like we send off different signals to those that are talking to us. And the amount of clients that feedback and say, I felt like I was heard for the first time. They would have about 15 or 20 minutes to talk about their experience. Then in the first session, they would be guided through a relaxation meditation. It would be recorded, probably, the relaxation, so that they could take it away and relax a few times using it before the second session. I've missed a point a bit out. After the client has kind of expressed their experience, the practitioner asks a couple of very simple, what we call outcome-focused questions, and the answers to those would be used in the second session. So the client comes back to the second session. They are led through a longer guided meditation. And that's it, really, apart from a follow-up in the third session. Three sessions are enough. To be honest, one session would be enough, but we kind of have made the choice to split it up into three to make it more accessible to our clients.
So in the last few years, how many people have you trained up to deliver this process?
Well, on our private student group, we've got about 328 students that are either going through the accreditation process or have already gone through and choose to stay in that group rather than move to a practitioner group. So about 330 practitioners in the last 4 years, I'd say.
That's really amazing. Good job, Mark.
Yeah, well, I did share that process early on with some colleagues. So a friend of mine, Mia Scotland, worked with me early on, and Alex Heath. I know Alex now does training, and as does Mia, I think. So I can't claim it all as my own. But yeah.
Cool.
So what's some of the feedback you've received from people who have experienced the Rewind?
Well,
not the process, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. You can call it Rewind if you want. Well, we've been gathering data in the context of anonymous surveys, and we've been doing that digitally for about 3 years now, maybe 3.5 years. That involves the client going to a SurveyMonkey link and answering three questions. The three questions are very simple. First one is, did you receive benefit from this process? Second question is, would you recommend this practitioner to someone else? And the third question is, what, if anything, would you change in how the practitioner worked with you? Now, in response to that first question, 100% of the respondents say that the process has made a difference in their lives. Now, the clients can respond with either a couple of words or a paragraph. I would say 30 to 35% of clients write a paragraph and talk about the process transforming their lives. You know, I had one client write about the work of a student that they had suffered for 15 years as a result of this experience, which was an attack, which was sexual in nature. That had 30 sessions of CBT.
Cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah. For sure. And in three sessions, they said the weight had lifted from them and they felt free. And that is not uncommon to read in the feedback that we get from clients, both men and women. Yeah.
Just imagine that 15 years of carrying this around with you, being triggered by different things, having flashbacks, having your life limited by this awful experience. And then less than three hours and going forward free.
And it happens often enough for me to remember it, you know, I'm moved to tears often, mm-hmm. Because it's very easy to read the words and not connect with all those years of suffering. So yeah, anecdotally, it's not research. It's not even audit, but anecdotally, 100% of those who have responded to the survey say that the process has made a difference in their life in some way or other.
Yeah. Powerful, Mark.
Mm. Yeah, I'm excited. I'm pleased to be doing it. You know, it feels, I'm 57. I'm a long way from dying, God willing, or whoever willing. But it is where I want to be focused until I stop actively being able to work. Because I think there is a desperate need. It's such a simple process to learn, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a bit of pre-learning, about 3 hours worth of pre-learning, the two-day training, 10 till 3, and then a consolidation video and then support through accreditation. It's such a simple process to learn. And when we think that of those 8% of the 200,000 women that end up getting diagnosed with PTSD, for example, they will wait 8 weeks for a referral, if not longer. Not to mention all those women that just grin and bear their birth experience, yeah, not knowing that something as simple as this can make such a difference. So it's worth spending the rest of my life doing, I think.
Yeah. And I think we're right behind you. You know, we're really happy to share this work far and wide, and not only just with the people that have had babies, but also to the people that work in the environments that are supporting people having babies, that are witnessing traumatic things day by day,
yeah,
or something else. So this work is it's kind of limitless, really, and can help and serve everybody.
Yeah, I believe that. I you know, sometimes people say, oh, it's dangerous and all this kind of stuff, and I think that all flows from a misunderstanding of the process itself. You know, not all trainings are the same. Mine isn't better or worse than any of the others. My training is based on the fundamental model, and I think few of the other trainings are. And I often say to people who say it's dangerous and blah, 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 please send me the evidence, either anecdotal or otherwise. And I mean this wholeheartedly. If the evidence was there that this caused harm, I would stop.
Of course, yeah, because this whole thing is about helping people, not making it worse.
Yeah, I know cognitive bias sometimes makes it difficult. You know, it's easy for people to say, if the evidence was there, I would stop. But they're so committed to what they're doing that everything around them confirms that it's right, and any other evidence is just conspiracy against it, right? But I like to think that I'm open enough that if there was evidence, I would stop. But anecdotally, the stuff that I've kind of gleaned from people that have been through the process helps to support the passion for training it. And I'm not going to stop.
Well, given that your feedback has been 100% positive, not even neutral or indifferent,
no,
let alone say negative of, oh, it really didn't really help or
well,
didn't.
Yeah, you know, well, that's a good point you make, Claire, because not one of them says, nah, it didn't help much, or it was a waste of my time.
Yeah.
So we haven't even had that. Let alone someone who's saying I was worse afterwards, mm-hmm. You know, so it kind of gives me a little bit of confidence, Claire.
Yeah, but it feels like more than ever this work is really, really needed, and perhaps needed for the midwives, for the doctors, for the obstetricians, for all the care providers, that they themselves are under huge strain and stress at the moment. As someone who, you know, was a midwife, working with people and no doubt had to deal with stress and strains of that job as well, how do you think we can help?
Well, I trained fairly recently, actually, a couple of midwives who work as support midwives for other midwives who are suffering. So they're taking this work into their role within the NHS and offering support. You know, as a young midwife, I remember going to work dreading being on labour ward. You know, the mere thought that I would be sent to labour ward, and I started to panic. You know, this simple process will work for that experience. You know, so that doesn't mean that I will never panic again when I go to the labour ward. It just means that I have a somewhat blanker sheet when I go into the hospital, because this work will have an effect on those triggers that trigger that to run. So my midwifery colleagues that are working within the NHS, I just feel desperately sorry for them. Because what they really need is not a guided meditation, but is more money and more midwives. The role that you have in kind of antenatal birth preparation is really important in many, many ways. Partners of breastfeeding women that have been trained in the physiology of breastfeeding lead to exponential rises in breastfeeding longevity. And that was shown in Brighton and in Australia. So that kind of information, the preloading of information that enables them to have more choices available when they are confronted with something that doesn't go as they were expecting, increases the longevity of breastfeeding over time. Seems to, right? The same, I think, potentially applies when we are giving birth education or seeking to facilitate birth education in women. And there is a really delicate balance, which is not easy to achieve, between making sure that the woman and her partner has the information they need if something deviates from a inverted commas normal physiology. Mm-hmm. You know, doing that in such a way that is not a suggestion that it could happen or will happen is a real challenge, right? Mm. And that's the balance that I think we haven't got great across birthing education organizations. There's been almost like a defensive response to the medicalization of birth. You know, and if we're not careful, we've communicated a them and us situation. Now, the patriarchy is at work in birthing institutions. You can't argue with that. Time limits, gadgets, partograms, vaginal examinations to measure progress. All of these things are part of a patriarchal birthing institution. But I have to extend my heart towards the medical establishment and assume that everything they do is a loving response for fear of the life of the person they're looking afterwards. They're not seeking to strip people of power. They are not seeking to manipulate others. This is them doing their best given the way they see the world. So this balance for me has to be there, because a cesarean birth could happen.
Yeah.
A Ventoux or Kiwi birth could happen. Syntocinon may be offered. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having the choice to respond in that moment with knowledge is important.
And I think a lot comes down in the language, not only in the pre-education. So if I'm teaching, I will try not to use a phrase like, you might have a forceps birth, because that's putting in an idea. So yeah. I will spend quite a lot of my mind concentrating on saying some people might experience this,
yes,
and other people might experience that. So I'm not putting it on the person.
Very good.
I think when we get into the birth space, sometimes when I hear people's stories back, even when they've had a moment where they've tried to create a moment of empowerment, where, say, for example, it all looks like things need to go down, say, for example, a cesarean route, and that birthing woman's kind of had a moment to get her head around it and to try and claim back her empowerment, she said, okay, yeah, I have decided it's time for a cesarean, to then have the person supporting her go, well, you haven't really got any choice, have you? And take the power back again. Yeah. And it's like, oh my God, do you not know the power of your language in that moment?
Yeah.
You could have gone, brilliant, great choice. Is there anything else you need? Okay, let's take you in and we'll all do this together. They could have said it in such a different way.
Yeah.
And it's that thing about language that kind of makes me cross and think that we need to do it institutionally and with all of us birth workers supporting parents on the grassroots level.
Because, you know, changing our language is very cheap. It's not an expensive intervention.
And it's about awareness. And as soon as you understand it, it's like your language changes. And when you hear it done like that, that example, gosh, it grates.
Yeah, it does. You, in fact, when you've been introduced to some of these principles, it's easy because you hear it everywhere. I want to recommend a YouTube interview I did, Caitlin Walker, I think. And she's an NLP-er, but has developed clean modeling and clean language, symbolic modeling and clean language. And she talks about her birth experience using clean language.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a recommendation for you too. I think you'd really enjoy the interview. And it has profound implications for how we teach women to respond in the birth environment when they're being offered choices or not being offered choices. So take a look at that. You see, the other thing about birth education, the organizations that skew towards reacting to medicalization inadvertently potentially set up the possibility for a woman to label her experience as traumatic.
Mm.
You know the old saying, disappointment takes a lot of planning. You know, disappointment takes a lot of planning. And if someone is exposed to the kind of rhetoric that would encourage the idea that vaginal birth is best, inverted commas, you know, that kind of language can have potential implications. Now, don't get me wrong, physiological birth vaginally is obviously optimum from an evolutionary point of view, because if you didn't birth vaginally through your pelvis, you just didn't survive. You know, evolution has now enabled our neurophysiology to come up with surgical processes, which are part of the evolutionary process, and therefore natural. You know, the understanding of the word natural, it has its roots in theology. The idea was against God's natural order or for God's natural order. In that definition, homosexuality becomes unnatural because it's against God's natural order, according to the Bible.
Yeah.
But if we take that word back from the theologians, and we say anything which is possible, given the laws of our physics, is natural, then cesarean birth becomes natural in that context because it is the fruit of an evolutionary process. Our neurophysiology. Does that make sense? Yeah. A cesarean birth becomes natural because it's possible. Well, and I looked after a client. I remember it vividly. I was quite young and I was with them all through a shift and into the night because I stayed. And a long story short, had a long second stage, had to go to theatre for a trial of forceps, ended up with a cesarean birth. And the baby's head was so far down in the pelvis that I had to get under the bed, conduct a vaginal examination to push the baby's head up while the surgeon was gently levering the baby out. And when the baby came out, it had my fingerprints on its head as I was pushing up. And the woman and her partner were ecstatically happy. And she felt amazingly exhilarated and proud at what she had accomplished. You know, given that scenario, any outcome could have been possible. She could well have labelled that as traumatic, but she didn't. And in part, that was because of how we were using language around her. You know, to sum all this up, I guess, Shakespeare's quote in Hamlet hits the mark for me every time. Things are neither good nor bad, but thinking make them so.
And when we're talking about the natural, is it natural and so on, actually all of that is kind of completely irrelevant, because it's how you feel, exactly as your fantastic warrior mama felt there. She really was ecstatic, and that's what matters. And you know, equally, we know people who have had textbook normal, natural, whatever you want to put a label on it, who certainly do not feel that way.
Yeah.
So it is kind of irrelevant. It is about in the eye of the beholder, going back to your very first comments.
And that ties in so brilliantly with yoga philosophy again, where there is no good or bad, there just is.
One little last question from myself. I've read in lots of places the idea that connection is perhaps the antidote to trauma, or perhaps the preventative of trauma, and that trauma kind of comes about
from
a feeling of disconnection, in whatever shape that might take. So do you think that with that kind of idea in mind, as you were speaking about preparing birth partners to be supportive of breastfeeding, that actually having someone in the room there whose job is purely connection might really make all the difference? Is this why the statistics around doulas?
Yeah, definitely. If you look at O'Driscoll Hospital way back in the 90s, the O'Driscoll Hospital in, I think it's Northern Ireland, or is it Southern Ireland? I'm not sure. It's called the Rotund Hospital. And the research is done by O'Driscoll. And O'Driscoll pioneered active management of labour. So it was his philosophy that you give syntocinon and you get labour done in 12 hours. From the start to the end, you augment the birthing process and you finish it within 12 hours. They reduced their caesarean section by quite a profound level. Back in the 90s, it led to the current fad of speeding labour up. When they looked at that paper in retrospect, and the research was kind of repeated and found actually it wasn't the active speeding up of the labour with syntocinon that made the difference. It was the continuous support of the birth attendant that made the difference, not the syntocinon. See, I would say that from an evolutionary point of view, we are herd animals, and we have spent many thousands of years feeling unsafe if we're not part of the herd. So for me as a midwife, the sharing of who I was or am as a person was really important to the giving of support and care to birthing women. So it was not unprofessional for me to share who I am as a person with them. And that's not an easy thing to do as a health professional when you're busy and when you've got lots of tasks. But the more that I could connect with them as people, having a shared experience, the more effective I felt my care was.
Yeah. And that requires you to be able to connect to yourself first.
Yeah.
And to get over some of your own stuff and move all that out of the way.
Yeah.
First, so you can show up purer and more in your power.
Yeah. Which is no small feat, because because we're all less likely to see patterns in ourselves than in others. You know, we've got 20/20 vision for other people's patterns, but I am often blind to my own. You know, it's just like I often say, my children are walking in the footsteps I thought I'd covered up. You know, people catch what we've got, not what we say we've got. You know, so I might be talking the talk of choice, but behaving in a way that is removing choice. You know, the words that we say are a small portion of what we communicate. Whole bodies are communicating sometimes the opposite of what we're saying. So it's not an easy skill, but yeah. Being able to weep with a client, being able to laugh with a client, you know, sharing something of who I am as a person, that level of connection enhanced my care hundredfold.
And we see that needed not only in the birth space, but when people are ill, when people are dying, when people are going through difficult divorces, when kids are coming home saying they've been bullied. You know, it's about showing up, connecting, being present, and being with it all.
And you know, and if we just want to talk about evolution, you know, we are herd animals. And at one point in our history, if we weren't part of the herd, we were dead. You know, and I would say most, if not all, of my patterns of connecting with others are potentially linked to the fear of dying, not being part of this herd. You know,
and it speaks true as well to the conversations I've had with shamanic midwives from Mexico and Colombia who don't understand our concept of, say, postnatal depression in their communities. And it's because they have so much connection and so much support that the mother's not left alone in her house with a baby. Everyone's gone off to work. Everyone's celebrated and all gone away again. I think being isolated and being alone, it's pretty, having some sort of depression is almost like a logical outcome of that. So more support, more connection is needed on so many levels in the whole of our weaving of culture and society.
Yeah.
So to bring it back round to what our listeners might need to know, if they resonate with anything that we've been talking about in this podcast, if they are aware of their trauma or they're not aware of their trauma, but they're having panic attacks, hypervigilance, issues with bonding, daily struggles, what would be their first kind of port of call to find some support?
Well, as a midwife who's still registered with the NMC, I would say a GP is always a gateway to other support and evaluation and all of that. If you wanted to explore the process that I teach, I can vouch for all the practitioners who are on the webpage at www.birthingawarenesstraining.com. If you click on the practitioner tab, all of the practitioners there I can vouch for. I can't say the same for any other Rewind training organization, but I can vouch for them. And I can guarantee that you will receive gentle support to relieving your suffering. The first thing I would always say if someone is feeling like they're struggling alone is that you're not alone. In fact, my emotions go up and down, and I struggle from month to month with managing uncontrolled emotional responses. And there are thousands of other women who are struggling in the same way. And the first thing to do is to share that with someone. Professionally, probably the GP, but otherwise a trusted friend. Yeah.
Thank you. And Claire and I are, of course, some of your accredited practitioners. So you can also contact Claire or myself through the website. We are going to have a special dedicated page to people so they can access us if they would like to do the process with us. And if there are any other birth workers listening out there, I know a lot of our teachers listen to this podcast and you would like to train with Mark. In fact, I think we've had a couple of already have come to you. Then get in touch with Mark at his Birthing Awareness. We'll just say a big thank you to you, Mark, for coming on today and talking to us. I think a lot of people will have learned an awful lot from what you have to say. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Until next time, Mark.
Bye.